Coming up, as the focus of the Syrian crisis turns suddenly from an imminent U.S. military strike to international diplomacy, many religious leaders continued their campaigns for a peaceful solution. We explore with William Galston the moral considerations. Also, Kim Lawton on the 50th anniversary of the Ku Klux Klan bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, which killed four young black girls.
It shook the very fabric of our society broadly, not only in Birmingham, but in the country.
And celebrating the joy and value of life during the Jewish ritual of Kever Avot, visiting the graves of loved ones.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. There were major efforts this week to prevent a U.S. military strike against Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry began meeting with Russian officials to explore a possible agreement with Syria to turn over its chemical weapons to international supervision. Earlier, President Obama maintained his support for a strike, but asked Congress to delay voting on it so the diplomatic talks could take place. Religious groups around the world, meanwhile, ramped up their opposition to U.S. military action. At the Vatican, thousands joined Pope Francis at a prayer vigil for peace. And in Washington, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, head of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, warned against a military strike.
We've learned the hard way. Violence spurs more violence, and all the time it's the innocent people. Many of them, suffering Christians and other vulnerable minorities who pay the worst price.
Kim Lawton, our managing editor, joins me now to talk about the moral considerations regarding Syria with William Galston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Bill, welcome. What would be so bad about saying, okay, we're not going to send any missile strikes into Syria, and you give up all your chemical weapons in return? Isn't that a pretty good deal?
At the end of the day, those two issues may be linked. But right now, as Secretary Kerry has rightly said, it is only the threat of force that has brought the Syrians to this point, a point that they have resisted for decades. They have not been a signatory to the Chemical Weapons Convention until the past few days. So that it is unrealistic to forswear the use of force unless and until an agreement can be reached that achieves the objectives.
Mm-hmm. Part of the issue for those who supported the military strikes was that it's not just a deterrent to prevent this from happening in the future, but it would also have been a punishment to show Assad and whomever else that the world will not tolerate that. If there is a diplomatic settlement, does that in some way lessen the moral consequence of doing those kind of acts?
In a way, it does. And that's on one side of the moral scales. On the other side of the moral scales is the fact that the use of force is always, from the moral point of view, a last resort. Once you initiate the use of force, not only will there be inevitably collateral damage, civilian deaths, but also unintended consequences. So with all of that on the other side of the scale, if we can really achieve the internationalization and then the destruction of these terrible weapons that the world has forsworn for a century now, then I think that's a defensible bargain. But we're a long way from having reached that point, unfortunately.
Bill, what happens if the diplomacy does not work? What happens if it just goes on and on and on and nothing?
Well, in my view, the President and the Secretary of State would be well advised to make it clear that this is not going to be an unending diplomatic process. We're not going to get sucked into a morass that leaves us months from now in the same place that we are now. And the president, I think, should make that crystal clear. Whether he should issue an ultimatum with a date certain is a tactical question that I'll leave to others to determine. But he has to eliminate the possibility of an open-ended negotiation.
There was an interesting exchange this week. At the end of his address on Tuesday, President Obama said, "We have to act. This is who we are. It's what makes America exceptional." Then the Russian president, you know, said back, "Hey, it's dangerous to say we're exceptional. God created everybody equal." What role does American exceptionalism, this idea we're special, play in U.S. foreign policy, and what should it play?
Well, let's reduce that idea to its practical essentials for current purposes. I mean, American exceptionalism is an idea with a very long history, and it has to do with the religious basis of the country, with our institutions, with our special history, with the universal principles that we stand for. But right now, practically, American exceptionalism means that the peace is secured through the presence of American power around the world. For example, the freedom of the seas is guaranteed by the United States Navy in a way that, in the same way that in the previous century, it was guaranteed by the British Navy. And if we were to stand down or move back, the result would not be spontaneous peace, it would be anarchy. If you like Somali pirates, you'd see a lot more of them absent the U.S. Navy. So American exceptionalism means right now that we're the only country with the ability to deter a bunch of bad guys from doing a bunch of bad things in all sorts of different areas.
But Bill, quickly, does that mean we have a responsibility to intervene any place in the world where the dictators are doing bad things to their people?
Absolutely not. The president has made that point clear. But the fact that we have neither the responsibility nor the capacity to intervene everywhere doesn't mean that we have the right to intervene nowhere. We should do what we can consistent with possibility.
Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution, many thanks to you.
My pleasure.
In other news, faith groups were among those who marked the 12th anniversary of 9/11. At an annual unity walk in Washington, members of different religions came together to promote interfaith understanding. The day included visits to several houses of worship and prayers led by a diverse group of clergy. There was also a large community service project where people prepared food for local food banks. Pope Francis this week stressed the need for dialogue between believers and non-believers. The Pope's comments came in a letter published in Italy's popular paper, La Repubblica. One of the paper's founders, an atheist, had written to the Pope asking whether God forgives those who have no faith. Francis responded that God's mercy has no limits, and those who do not believe in God must obey their own consciences. Earlier this year, the Pope made a similar statement, saying atheists who do good can be redeemed. As Congress returned to Washington, religious leaders renewed their push for comprehensive immigration reform. A group called the Interfaith Immigration Coalition announced 40 days of prayer, fasting, and advocacy. At a ceremony in the U.S. Capitol this week, the Congressional Gold Medal, the nation's highest civilian honor, was awarded posthumously to four young black girls who were killed during the bombing of a Birmingham, Alabama church 50 years ago. On September 15, 1963, less than 3 weeks after the March on Washington, members of the Ku Klux Klan set the bomb to go off Sunday morning at 16th Street Baptist Church. Kim Lawton has our special report on the impact of that event then and now.
It's Sunday morning at 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Sunday school is finished, and the 11 o'clock worship service has just gotten underway. Today, the youth choir is singing. This is how things were supposed to go on that Sunday morning 50 years ago as well. Then a bomb made of at least 10 sticks of dynamite exploded, killing four young girls inside the church.
It shook the very fabric of our society broadly, not only in Birmingham, but in the country, because the four little girls dressed in white for Sunday school can be blown to pieces because of hatred. Everyone has to stop and think, where are we going as a society?
The bombing came amid ongoing racial turmoil in Birmingham and across the U.S. At the beginning of 1963, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had decided to make Birmingham the center of a new nonviolent campaign to end segregation. For years, many Birmingham churches had been fighting segregation under the leadership of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. But the largely middle-class 16th Street Baptist Church had not taken an active role in that effort. Glenn Eskew is professor of history at Georgia State University and author of the book, But for Birmingham.
When King arrived in Birmingham to join in the demonstrations that had been organized with Reverend Shuttlesworth and the local movement, he was surprised to find that 16th Street Baptist was not one of the movement churches.
Because of shared Baptist connections, King persuaded 16th Street's pastor, Reverend John Cross Jr., to let him use the church as his headquarters for civil rights rallies. Then in early May, 16th Street Church became the staging ground for a series of demonstrations featuring students, some as young as elementary school age. The children gathered in the church and then came out singing and marching. They were met with police dogs and fire hoses. Hundreds of young people were arrested. Their bravery inspired adults to join in, and the mass protests created a huge challenge for the city.
In the wake of the demonstrations, white leaders in Birmingham had agreed to begin dismantling segregation. By late summer of 1963, African Americans were starting to be hired in some local businesses. But most controversial of all were new efforts to integrate public schools.
With tensions in the city high, 16th Street Baptist was trying to return to business as usual.
Having gone through the demonstrations in the spring of 1963, it had become seen as a symbol of that successful protest movement. But the congregation itself had not completely embraced the protests and wanted to go back to a kind of normalcy.
Reverend Carolyn McKinstry was 14 years old in 1963. She had marched in the Children's Crusade that May and was at 16th Street Baptist on the morning of September 15th. She and her friends had been in Sunday school and were getting ready for the worship service.
We were especially excited because it was Youth Sunday. This meant that we were in charge of everything.
McKinstry remembers chatting with four friends who were in the restroom. Then, because her job was to collect the Sunday school reports, she headed up to the church office just before 10:20.
The phone in the office was ringing, so I went in and answered it, and the person on the other end, the male caller on the other end, said 3 minutes. And just as quickly as he said that, he hung up the phone. And so I'm holding all of these materials, and I just begin walking, and I take about 15 steps into the sanctuary, and then this bomb just explodes.
The explosion ripped through the side of the building, blew out the granite foundations. The bomb itself having been placed under an outside staircase going up to a second-story landing and door.
When I first heard the windows crashing in, and it felt sort of like the earth shook there, the building moved or something, and then the windows came crashing in, and I heard screams.
There was significant structural damage and multiple injuries. Then, amid the chaos, came the more devastating news. Four girls had never made it out of the restroom. Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley, who were all 14, and Denise McNair, who was just 11.
I knew so clearly that it could have very easily been me.
Freeman Hrabowski is president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He lived in Birmingham and was 12 that year. He had also marched and been arrested in May.
It was like war. Because the point was, if a church can be bombed and little girls killed, no one is safe anywhere.
In the aftermath of the bombing, blacks and whites clashed in the street, and before the day was over, two young black men had been shot to death. The bombing shocked people outside Birmingham, especially because it had happened amid optimism after the successful March on Washington less than 3 weeks earlier.
That exercise of true democracy that had just transpired was really shattered by this explosion in Birmingham. And for many in the nation, it awoke them to just how difficult this task was going to be.
But it also galvanized people in the North and the South to lobby even harder for the Civil Rights Act, which was signed into law the following year. Hrabowski attended the funeral service that was held for three of the girls in his church, Sixth Avenue Baptist.
I saw people of all faiths there. It was the first time I'd ever seen somebody white in my church. And there was this long line of these people who were devastated. And there was something about that that was transformative for me to see that whites cared about little black girls.
King preached the funeral sermon, telling the crowd that suffering can be redemptive and the means to ultimately bring light into darkness.
And Dr. King looked at these mothers and said, life can be as hard as steel. He was saying, all we have is God and our faith. Can't explain this. All we can do is pray. And that was the essence of what we all had to say.
Suspects affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan were identified within days of the bombing, but the FBI closed the case 5 years later with no indictments. Robert Chambliss was finally convicted of murder in 1977. Two more men were also eventually convicted in the case, the last one not until 2002. McKinstry grew up to be a Baptist minister and wrote a book called While the World Watched.
My focus is just forgiveness, reconciliation, restorative justice, learning, number one, to put the past behind, to forgive, but also learning, looking for those times when there may be a way to restore justice and hope.
As the nation marks the anniversary of the bombing, many say the real message must never be forgotten.
We've changed so dramatically in the past 50 years, but we need to be aware that humans are capable of all kinds of things, and that we must forever guard against this kind of violence from taking place.
God, you are great!
With the help of many donations from around the world, 16th Street Baptist Church reopened in June 1964. The events of 50 years ago still resonate with the youth here.
They didn't know that the bomb that they put in this church was going to make such a big deal that it ended segregation, basically.
16th Street Baptist Church has been designated a World Heritage Site, but Pastor Arthur Price Jr. says they don't want to be defined only by their past.
We embrace our history and we see it as a opportunity to tell people about the grace and glory of God, how God in his providence spared this church so they can have a story to tell about his goodness and his mercy.
Price says the church continues to stand as a national testament to how tragedy can indeed turn into triumph. I'm Kim Lawton in Birmingham.
Now, belief and practice. This week, a special commemoration within the Jewish High Holy Days, which end this weekend with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. It's called Kever Avot and celebrates the joy and the sanctity of life. It immediately precedes visits to the graves of people's loved ones. Rabbi David Wolpe of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles was our guide.
Kevara Vote is a service that we conduct at the mortuary, at the cemetery, each year that allows people to come and have a memorial service that precedes their visiting the kever, that is the grave of their avot, of their ancestors. It's done during these 10 days because Rosh Hashanah really celebrates the beginning of the world. It's a time more of joy and discovery and wonder, and then you move gradually in self-examination to the deep contemplation of Yom Kippur. The shofar is a kind of alarm clock for the soul. We in particular blow it at this service because death is a very important theme in terms of the zest and goodness with which we live our lives. The Kevara Avot service reminds everyone, you don't have forever either. One day someone will come here and be mourning for you. So knowing that your time is limited in this world, use it wisely and well and with a certain amount of sanctity and holiness.
The greatest gift that those whom we have lost, those who have died, have given us is a chance to understand their lives so that ours might be better. How we will be remembered is in our hands as long as we are here, because not only can you change your future, you can change your past. Please rise for the mourner's Kaddish.
The Kaddish is the Jewish basically prayer for the dead. It's when you're in mourning, you say the Kaddish.
Yitgadal v'yitgadash shemei rabah.
It makes no mention of God. It just talks about the greatness of God. But there is a very beautiful interpretation by a Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach who says what the Kaddish really is what the dead would say to you if they could speak from where they are. That is, they've experienced God's greatness after death, and they want the living to know. The El Malei Rachamim, which is literally God full of mercy, says, and I will give tzedakah, I will give charity on behalf of the person who has died. There are other times of the year when the individual may go to see the graves of his or her ancestors, but in terms of doing it as a community, this is the one time during the year when we gather and you see literally hundreds and sometimes thousands of people walk into the cemetery, and it reinforces the great truth that everybody has lost, that you can't live without losing. And there's some comfort in seeing all these people also grieving for those whom they've lost. One of the things that's remarkable about memory is that when you lose someone, your relation to them continues to change. That is, it's a living relation, even with somebody who's not there, because their legacy unfolds in you and you understand new things as time goes on. Repentance sometimes involves an acknowledgement of all of your heritage, what people have wanted for you, how you were raised, the debts that you owe to the dead, in a sense. Am I living the way I was taught to live by the people who raised me? And also, do I remember them the way they deserve to be remembered? Both those very powerful themes come together at this time. It is a Jewish tradition to ask forgiveness from somebody who's died. You ask forgiveness of God, of other people, and then of people who aren't there to be able to ask anymore. The tradition of leaving a stone on a grave is a beautiful one. Stones endure and flowers fade, and we think of the soul as being enduring. To the extent that your behavior determines your fate, and self-reflection and thought and prayer can help you change your behavior, this is the time of year to do it, because this is the rare time when you actually have dedicated moments to think, to reflect, to meditate. It doesn't happen very often in our lives, and so I think that this really is our chance to change who we are and therefore to change what becomes of us.
On our calendar this week, Wednesday night begins the 7-day Jewish festival of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Jews recall their ancestors' 40 years of wandering in the desert by building a fragile outside structure called a sukkah, which they use for prayers and meals. Finally, in line with Pope Francis's many gestures celebrating simplicity, he accepted this week from a priest in northern Italy the gift of a used stick shift 1984 Renault with 186,000 miles on it. The Vatican says Francis intends to drive it himself and that he does know how. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, including audio and video podcasts of this program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, vocalist Benita Washington performs Press On at the Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony, honoring the four girls killed in the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church.
Hope is gone. Just press on.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
PBS.